Good afternoon, everybody. It's my pleasure to have Minister Lavrov here with us today again at Raisina. So time is short, so we'll cut quickly to the chase. And I'm asking this question as someone from India. In India, often we say that, you know, we live in a very troubled neighborhood. We do not choose the friends and allies our partners make, our neighbors make.
The sound is not very clear.
No country has a choice of what friends or allies its neighbor is going to make. And they can be sometimes uncomfortable allies and friends. But we don't go to war over it. Now, what is it that leads Russia into this long protracted war about NATO expansion?
Well, I assume that the people who assembled here, they are political scientists. They are interested in following the international developments. And if this is the case, then for the last 20 some years, they should have understood the reasons why we are concerned about the Western policy towards Russia very well. Yesterday, I think, the French ambassador to Israel, who was personally participating in the discussions with between the Western leaders and Gorbachev, he confirmed that there was a commitment not to expand NATO. And then he added, but this does not mean that Russia is right in what it is doing in Ukraine. But between the lie about not expanding NATO and the events which started 1 year ago, there were so many developments which you cannot overlook. The lies continued, including the lies not about some oral promises, but about some commitments on paper. In OSCE, Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, during a summit in Istanbul in 1999, the political declaration was signed by the presidents and the prime ministers, which said security is indivisible and the OSCE participants are all committed to equal and indivisible security. Then they stated that each country is free to choose alliances, but in doing so, no country can strive to strengthen its security at the expense of the security of others. And then another principle was signed by the presidents and the prime ministers, according to which no country and no organization in the OSCE region can pretend to dominate militarily. If you read it again, it's clear that NATO violated all these commitments. By the way, it was 1999, and then it was repeated in 2010 at another OSCE summit in Kazakhstan. And when we started to ask questions, guys, you committed yourself not to increase your security at the expense of our security. Can you stop expanding NATO? They said, well, this is just political commitment.
But Minister, wait a second.
If you ask the question which I'm trying to answer, that means that you don't know what I'm telling you now. So when we said, okay, you said this is political commitment, let's make it a legal commitment, let's put all these principles in a legally binding treaty, indivisible security. You know what they told us? They said, you know, legally binding guarantees of security can only be obtained inside NATO. Just looking into our face, we told them, look, President Obama signed this particular paper. Well, this is political commitment, forget about this. And then there was another legally binding commitment, the resolution of the Security Council, which endorsed the Minsk agreements. It was very, very astonishing that all those who signed the Minsk agreements, except Putin, publicly admitted that they never intended to implement this particular Security Council resolution. So, no delivery on the oral commitments, no delivery on written commitments, no delivery on legally binding commitments. And all this was accompanied by NATO instructors beefing up Ukrainian army, Ukraine getting more and more weapons. As Merkel, Hollande, Poroshenko and Zelensky said, we needed the Minsk agreements to buy some time to get more and more weapons to Ukraine. And if you can check the reports of OSCE special monitoring mission, they registered sharp increase of the shelling of Donbas just in the beginning of February. 20-30 times more than the routine exchange of fire before that. So we defended our security, we defended the people, the Russian people, who had been denied by Poroshenko and Zelensky, denied the right to use the Russian language in education, in media, in culture, in everything. If you check the Ukrainian legislation passed after the coup brought to power this neo-Nazist regime, they cancelled legally, cancelled everything what has to do with the Russian language. And when the people who did not accept the coup in the east of Ukraine and in Crimea said, guys, leave us alone, we are not going to follow your policies, they were declared terrorists. And it is the regime who started the war against these people. That's why the Minsk agreements were considered, you know, the way to stop this. And it was not very difficult to implement the Minsk agreements. It was about the special status for a small part of the east of Ukraine, much smaller than the territory which is controlled by the Russian army now, much smaller. But they didn't want to do this, because the special status to be given to this small territory included the right to use the Russian language. And this in itself was considered a taboo by the Nazists who took the power in Ukraine through a coup. Then there was the right to have some local police, which is nothing unusual, and then the right to be consulted when judges and prosecutors are appointed for this particular region. By the way, this is exactly almost the same status as was promised to Kosovo Serbs in 2013, two years before the Minsk agreements. This community of Serbian municipalities of Kosovo. The same stuff and the same trick. Cheating on Serbia in case of a community of Serbian municipality of Kosovo, cheating on Russia in the case of the Minsk agreements. Special status for the Serbs in Kosovo, special status for Russians in Ukraine. In both cases, it was the European Union in the person of Germany and France, and also the High Representative regarding the Kosovo deal. And they, I am convinced that just like they admitted that they did not intend to implement the Minsk agreements, they never intended to implement the thing they promised the Serbs in Kosovo.
But the war, this military campaign, or whatever you call it, a war or enduring freedom operation, whatever name you may choose to call it, the bombing campaigns do not alter hearts and minds. They're the worst way to do it. In fact, they freeze people into positions, make further negotiations even more difficult.
Okay.
Where does this take us?
Yeah. Tell me, when this conference started, what year?
This is the eighth Reisner dialogue we're having.
Eighth year. You started in 2014 or something? Have you been interested during these years what is going on in Iraq, what is going on in Afghanistan? Have you been asking the United States and NATO whether they are certain of what they are doing? When Scholz and Baerbock, Macron and others say, this is the first time when the OSCE Helsinki Final Act is being violated. They don't remember about 1999 when Serbia was bombed, when Joe Biden, being a senator at that time, he was bragging that I, 1 year before the bombing of Serbia, I promoted this approach, and I believe that we have to bomb them out into peace. When Iraq was ruined as a state, after Colin Powell showed a vial with some powder, and then a few years later Tony Blair said, yes, it was a mistake, what to do?
No, but that is a lesson which needs to be learned.
Wait a second. If you believe that the United States has the right to declare a threat to its national interest any place on earth, like they did in Yugoslavia, in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria, 10,000 miles across the Atlantic Ocean, and they have the right to do so, and you don't ask them any questions, and Russia, not just overnight, like they did in Iraq and elsewhere, but for more than 10 years, warning them, guys, you are doing something which is going to be very bad.
But I think the question has been asked.
One second. Not across the ocean, but just on our borders, on the territories where the Russians lived for centuries and centuries and centuries. So if it is not a double standard, then I am not a minister, you know.
The question has been asked, and the experience in Iraq, Afghanistan, everywhere has been that it does not make sense to get into these long protracted wars to defend these kinds of interests. U.S. did not succeed. Why do you think Russia will succeed?
Well, you being the head of such distinguished audience, I fail to understand why you don't understand. It is,
no, we are, once, my once, simple once question, again, Mr. is, it is, it what, is, what is the end game?
It is the war against everything Russian in Ukraine. Can you imagine that, for example, in Ireland, they cancel the English language, or in Belgium, they cancel French, or in Switzerland, they cancel German, or in Finland, they cancel Swedish? Can you even imagine this? Of course not. But nobody lifted a finger, not the small one, not the middle one, when the Russian language was totally cancelled in Ukraine. We have been knocking on all these doors, OSCE, Council of Europe, guys, why don't you say something? Why don't you tell them to behave? And during all these 8 years, I don't recall that your conference was addressing this problem.
Hmm. See, the question everyone asks here, and that's what comes from the other side, is, oh, the end to the war is simple. If Russia stops fighting, the war ends. And then perhaps there can be negotiations. Is there some end game which you are playing or the other side is playing? Where does this all take us? See, countries in the region are aghast at what is happening. They're affected by what is happening. Food, fertilizer, energy.
Countries of the region are affected not by what we are doing in Ukraine. They are affected by the reaction of the West to what we are doing in Ukraine after we had warned them for decades, you know, that they should stop this expansion of NATO and pushing arms into Ukraine to prepare them for the war against us. I just participated yesterday in the G20 ministerial, and our Western friends were shouting in the microphones, Russia must, Russia must, Russia must, and all the developing delegates, they were also saying, you know, we want to stop the war when Russia is ready to negotiate. If you are really interested in politics and in the root causes of this particular situation, then you would know that Biden, Blinken, Stoltenberg, Borrell, repeatedly stated that Russia must be defeated on the battlefield. Russia must suffer strategic defeat. And this, they say, is existential for the West in the context of global domination. It's a very blunt admittance, I would say.
So both sides, and, the
and
way I look at it...
One second. The entire G20 was only about what to do with Ukraine and the final declaration, can we have it or not. I asked the Indian friends and the Indonesian friends who were cheering the G20 and those who were cheering G20 before Indonesia for all these long years, whether G20 ever reflected in those declarations situation in Iraq, in Libya, in Afghanistan, or in Yugoslavia, because G20 was formed in 1999 at the level of ministers of finance and central bank directors. And in 2008 it became summit G20. Nobody was giving a damn about anything except finances and macroeconomic policies which G20 was formed for. These days, when it is not something which the West is doing, believing this, that it is, it's right, when Russia has, after many years of warnings, started to defend itself, there is nothing except Ukraine which is of interest for G20. It's a shame. It's a shame, and this policy would fail. If they say this is existential for them, it is existential for us.
But there are lots of other countries out there who want peace, who want this war to end, and they would like somewhere a line to be drawn and negotiations to start. Now, what is the end game? Where do you see this? See, this war cannot go on forever. You do not be stuck here for 20 years and repeat Afghanistan all over again.
You would be ideal propagandist of the Soviet Union style, you know.
Thank you.
Calling for peace, calling against the war. I am trying to explain to you that it is not black and white, that the sufferings of others are not related to what we are doing in Ukraine to defend ourselves at all. These sufferings are related to the sanctions, to the policy of blackmail, the policy of diktat, which the West is promoting. You know that all of them, Blinken, Stoltenberg, Borrell, ministers of European countries, they travel all over the globe and tell the countries to behave, join sanctions, vote the way we tell you, and so on and so forth. If they are such big democrats, they should respect the right of other countries to take their own positions. Putin explained in great detail before we started this operation why we are doing this, why we didn't have any other choice. The West condemned. Treat others as grown-ups, as mature people. Don't tell them what position to take. The developing world basically was silent until the West started blackmailing them, threatening them, sanctioning those who would not sanction Russia. You know what? Many, many friends of me, of my mine in the developing world, they're telling me how this is being done. When the West says, the Americans tell them, you must vote this way or else. And they say, okay, I will vote the way you want me, because I believe this can be explained by the United Nations Charter and so on and so forth. But what do I get in return? And the answer from the Americans is, you would not be punished. Fair deal, very fair deal. Then I have quite a number of friends in New York, and when I was there for the last General Assembly, I talked to them, and they were many, if not most of them, were saying that they fully understand what is going on, and that we should not be angry at the way they vote. And they told me what arguments the Americans have been using when they persuaded people to vote in the General Assembly against Russia. The arguments are very straight. Don't forget that you have a bank account in such bank, and don't forget that your kids go to Stanford. Bluntly. And I'm sure that there are many people in this room who know that this is true.
So, Minister, we're running out of time, so just a last thing before I pass on for two quick questions from the audience. See, I agree that smart bombs don't exist, smart sanctions don't exist. No matter how much bombing you do, nothing is going to work out. You are going to cause damage, you are taking innocent lives all along. Similarly, smart sanctions, agree with you, don't exist. They will always be possibilities. Collateral damage is extremely high. So there, yes, both sides need to get together and find a solution. But the point is that somewhere there has to be a line drawn to, okay, let diplomacy have a chance. Let's start talking once again.
Look, you.
No, but I'll
you really surprised me.
The question,
my dear friend, you surprised me, because if you raise this issue,
yeah,
you should have done some homework. Do you know that Zelensky? Everybody is asking when Russia is ready to negotiate. When Russia is ready to negotiate, the West continuously is saying that it is not time to negotiate yet because Ukraine must win in the battlefield before any negotiations. And Zelensky himself, nobody calls on Zelensky asking him when he is going to negotiate, but you should have known, preparing for this topic at this meeting, that in September last year, Zelensky signed a decree making it a criminal offense to negotiate with Russia as long as Putin is president. So can you address this issue? Can you invite him and ask him what he is doing?
Can I take two quick questions from our Aisana young fellows? I'm sorry, we are out of time.
He is our man. He is from Russia.
What did he say?
Sorry, you'll have to come to a mic. Aisana young fellows, please sit down. Please sit down. I've not taken your question.
Why not?
The first question goes to Aisana young fellows.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm Ryosuke Hanada. Rational young fellow.
Speak louder.
Yes, my question is about the Sino-Russia relations and its impact on the India-Russia relations, because India is now facing China's assertive challenges in its Himalayan border and the Indian Ocean region. So from last year, there's a dramatic change in the Russia-China relations. There's many joint exercises around Japan, around India. So how does Russia calculate the strategic cost and benefit of deepening its relationship with China, especially its impact on Russia-India relations? Thank you.
Well, we never make friends against somebody. We have excellent relations with China and excellent relations with India. The relations with India are characterized in the official documents signed by the two leaders as especially privileged strategic partnership. I don't know whether any other country has the same status on paper, officially, with our Indian friends. But this is what we believe is reflecting the reality, be it economy, be it technology, be it military cooperation, military technical cooperation, culture, humanitarian ties, educational ties. And we have relations with China that, are they never been that good from the very beginning of the existence of China. And we are interested in these two great nations to be friends. And we are trying to be helpful. It was at the initiative of my great predecessor, Evgeny Primakov, that RIC was created, Russia, India, China, Troika. He initiated this, and this was the beginning of the process which eventually culminated in BRICS formation. And now BRICS is very popular among about 24 countries who would like to join. But the momentum was ensured by the decision to create this troika, Russia, India, China. And you might not hear about this as much as of BRICS, but this troika continues to function. We met last year, and we are going to meet this year again at the ministerial level. I think it would be 21st or 22nd meeting already. Experts in economy, in trade, and technology also meet. Think tanks people meet regularly. They were supposed to meet actually sometimes this spring, but then our Indian colleagues asked for some postponement. My feeling is the more they meet, the better. And RIC is a platform for India and China in our presence, because they might not feel themselves comfortable being one-on-one all the time, you know, to find some additional common grounds. BRICS is another platform. And of course, we strongly supported India joining Shanghai Cooperation Organization, including from the point of view of providing another place where India and China can cooperate together and can look for some common solutions. So, and we will continue this policy. We never engage in playing any country against any other country. And this is, unfortunately, what is being tried by some other outside players in the context of so-called Indo-Pacific strategies, in the context of AUKUS, in the context of using Quad, not for economic purposes, but trying to militarize Quad. The idea promoted by our American friends of ASEAN plus Quad is openly aimed at ruining East Asia summits. In other words, it would be East Asia summits minus China and minus Russia. These are the questions which I believe you should address more openly and honestly. Those are the risks created for this region. Russia would always be in favor of bringing people together, like we do in many other countries.
Second question over there.
Minister, my question is very simple.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Mridula and I'm from India, another young Raisina young fellow. Just a related question on how the war has affected Russia's strategy on energy, and will it mark a pivot towards Asia? And if it does, how is India going to feature in it?
Can you repeat this? Acoustics.
How has this war affected Russia's energy interests?
Energy.
Is it pivoting towards Asia? And is it the deepening relationship about gas into India and all that she's asking about?
You know, the war which we are trying to stop and which was launched against us using Ukrainian people, of course, it influenced the policy of Russia, including energy policy, and the blunt way to describe what is the change, what changed, we would not anymore rely on any partners in the West. We would not allow them to blow the pipelines again. By the way, we asked for investigation, and immediately this investigation request was denied. The Americans called it a nonsense, and when Seymour Hersh published his findings, you saw what the reaction of Europeans and the Americans was. Germany was humiliated, and physically and morally and in any other way. Everything which is happening now is to reduce Europe to subordinate player for the United States, to undercut European competitive edge, And of course, to ruin the economic link between Russia and European Union. This is very obvious. So be it. If this is the choice of them, which fits, by the way, in the rhetoric, in the narrative that what is going on is existential for the West from the point of view of its ability to dominate, then everything fits into place.
Thank you, Minister.
And the energy policy of Russia will be oriented towards reliable partners, credible partners. India and China are certainly among them.
Thank you so much, Minister. It was great talking to you. A pleasure having you here in Raisina. I hope next time we meet in Raisina, we meet in less contentious times. Are we going to promise that? Come.
Well, the Americans would certainly suggest some questions which you can use.
Thank you very much.